It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to be with us on the Tuesday edition of It's Your Turn. A rainy day. Started out with ice this morning. Boy, a lot more ice than we were counting on, huh? It was nasty. Now it's just ugly out there. It's chilly and wet. And well, we'll make our own sunshine today, and we'll certainly do that with our first guest who joins us by telephone. He is Rocky Blyer, former star running back with the Pittsburgh Steelers, wounded Vietnam veteran, and it's just going to be great to be able to talk with him for a few minutes. Rocky, nice to have you with us today, my friend.
Well, thank you very much, Dave. Thanks for having me on your show. Yes.
The occasion is...
So it's amazing. You had ice up there this morning, right, mm-hmm. in Butler County and so on. I was just thinking it's amazing what a couple miles would do coming down. We didn't have as much... we didn't get the ice as some of the cities going north. It rained. Still gives misty. It's just one of those nasty days today. But anyway, so no ice, but... That's good.
Yeah, Pittsburgh had just rain all morning, and during the overnight, we had a lot of ice up here.
Oh, well, yeah, that's worse. Anyway, so good.
I think most folks around here are at least vaguely familiar with Rocky Blyer. Perhaps a new generation or two, not so much. But the occasion for us to chat with the Rocky Blyer is the fact that he has now a revised and updated and expanded edition of his biography, called Fighting Back. You originally wrote your story, gosh, Rocky, it was back in the 70s, wasn't it, when you first wrote this book?
You're right. I mean, the time goes. It was 1975. We came out with a book, the first edition of Fighting Back, written by Terry O'Neill, who was a friend of mine and a New Kensington native, actually. Worked for ABC at the time. Notre Dame grad, a couple years behind me, and he approached me about doing a book. We're going into Super Bowl IX, our first Super Bowl, and down in New Orleans, and so that's when it started, and we came out in 1975. And so it was a success at that time, and like every other book, you know, you go, okay, fine. 20 years later, I wrote an epilogue on it just to bring it up to date, and we did another one, just a chapter. But it was interesting, and people may be asking, well, why did you bring it out again, or why, you know, if you've already written it, why? What's the interest now? And I think that, part of it was that I would get comments, you know, traveling around the country and from Steeler fans specifically or from people in Pittsburgh that would at least make mention to me. You know, the first book that I ever read in junior high or in high school on how to do a report on it was your book, Fighting Back. And, you know, I remember that and so on and so on. Then all of a sudden, you know, I got to thinking, you know, there's a whole new generation out there that does not know necessarily the Rocky Blyer story, not that they need to know, but it's kind of a universal story of overcoming odds and not giving up and having hope in one's life and coming to the obstacles of life and overcoming them and, you know, getting a chance to play and then play on a team that ultimately won 4 Super Bowls. So I thought, well, maybe this would be a good idea to bring the book back. And so rather than me writing an epilogue or an update, I reached out to my good friend Gene Collier, and Gene wrote 2 chapters for me at the end about my girls and bringing that up to date, my family and their story, and then also about the play that we had done, and so we got a whole new cover, a new print, new pictures, and I just thought it would be a great gift for parents and or grandparents to say, you know, I read this book back when I was your age, and I think that you should have it. So that was the reason behind it, and So then we formed a program, just that it's now called Fighting Back for Veterans. Proceeds of the book go to veteran organizations here in Western Pennsylvania and around the area, because it's about the chance or the ability of being able to give back to a community and to a section, and being a veteran, it's been a big part of my life and part of the story, and so we thought that would be a great addition to be able to at least get people interested in saying, hey, for a veteran organization, veteran causes, maybe I'll buy one for my grandson. So anyway, or granddaughter, I should say. But that was the reason why we did it.
Well, very generous of you to be donating the proceeds to veterans. But I think it's important for upcoming generations to know about your life story and what happened to you. Let's review that just a little bit for our listeners. First of all, Rocky, are you originally from this area, or?
No, actually I'm not. I'm from the state of Wisconsin. I grew up in a little town called Appleton, Wisconsin. Grew up in a neighborhood bar, shot in a beer joint. There's a lot of those around Western Pennsylvania, so it made me feel comfortable when I moved here. Actually, it was a mill town, Appleton is, not steel mill, paper mills, up and down the Fox River. And so when I came to Pittsburgh, it was like kind of home. It was like, well, we got a river here, or rivers, I should say, and in the same mentality of hardworking blue-collar, workers in towns up and down the rivers, and so I felt very comfortable. Now, when you have to understand, as I came out of the University of Notre Dame, and I was the 417th person picked in the draft that year, back in 1968, and I was a 16th round draft choice for the Pittsburgh Steelers, and somehow made the team as a rookie, and then during that rookie season, 1968, it was the height of the war in Vietnam, and thousands of young men prior and during that period of time were being drafted or enlisted, to serve our country, and I got drafted, and eventually wound up over in Vietnam in the Army. And after 4.5 months in the country, we ran into enemy activity, and I got wounded twice in the same day, one by AK-47 that pierced through my left thigh, and secondly by a grenade that blew up through my right foot, knee, and thigh. And the prognosis was that, I'd be all right, but I'd never be able to play this game of football because of the damage specifically to the nerves and the tendons in my foot. So, through the hard work or dedication or not giving up and for the kindness of the Steeler organization, I came back, and it was 1970, and I came back and I limped through training camp. They were kind enough to be able to tell me that maybe their doctors, and they put me in injured reserve that first year.
Yeah.
And so the second year I made the taxi squad, and then by 1972 I made the regular team, playing special teams and so on.
Wow.
Ultimately got a chance to play.
When you were wounded in Vietnam, as you said, twice on the same day, once by an AK-47, once by a grenade, were you helicoptered out of the combat zone? Or why wounded twice?
Eventually, yeah. So eventually... so we were in this firefight that had taken place, and then all of a sudden they retreated, and we didn't know at the moment. I didn't care, but later what I found out was that we possibly had killed their leader, and so they withdrew, and finally a platoon fought its way down and and dragged us out of there through the night until we got to a location where helicopters then did come in and lifted us to an aid station, then to Da Nang, where I spent several days, and before I came back to Tokyo, where I spent 3 weeks in the hospital before I came back here to the States, where I spent 9 months in the hospital and went through three more operations.
Wow. There was no exemption in the late 60s from the draft just because you were playing for an NFL football team, eh?
Well, no, that's right. I mean, so what would happen is that you could get into a reserve or try to get into reserves. But as I tell people, this was 1968, height of the war, and all the spots here were pretty filled. And so it was difficult to get in. And in the meantime, as we're trying that process, the draft came through my hometown, and that was Wisconsin, you know, and that was it. You got the call, and you went.
Yeah, there you go. When you came back to the United States after your lengthy surgeries and recuperation and so on your legs and your foot, did you ever meet personally with Art Rooney, the chief? Did he tell you, hang in there, we've got a spot for you?
I was in Tokyo, as a matter of fact, and it was right at the time, you know, that question that we all have of if you really want to do something. So the burning question I had was, what do you think, Doc, about my injuries? Will I be able to play this game? I mean, what do you think? And at that time, he just said, well, don't worry about it. You're going to have a normal life. Just don't expect to get back in the ground. And you just won't have the strength and the flexibility to be able to do the things that running backs need to do in the game of football. So what he had formulated at that moment in time was a perception about my ability, but as my authority figure, just kind of sucked that hope right out, you know, of any future in this game. Shortly thereafter, I did get a postcard mail, unbeknownst to me, and had two lines on it that this: Rock, team's not doing well, we need you. And that was from Art Rooney. And so it was kind of a sense of hope, or at least that somebody cared, you know, whether or not they weren't going to buy me a year, or at least I didn't think, but it was like that somebody knew that this is what I wanted to do. So, yeah, it gave you a sense of hope about being able to come back. And being the family that they were, as I had made mention before, they were kind enough, and they bought me a couple years of injured reserve, taxi squad, before I made the regular team in 1972.
Wow. Were you, you would have been slightly older than Franco Harris, but you did play with Franco, right?
Oh, that's right. Well, so Franco came in 1972, was his rookie year. I was playing special teams. I was still hanging on. There's about 4 years difference between us in age. And so, he came in 1972. Oh, right at Penn State, you know, the heralded number one pick, and obviously lived up to his credentials that first year. Even in 1972, MVP, Rookie of the Year, gained 1,000 yards rushing, even though he didn't start in the first couple games. And then in 1972, the Macklett reception turned things around as we went into the playoffs against the Oakland Raiders, you know, kind of set the tone for the remaining years to come. And so it was great being able to be a part of that team and that experience, and ultimately be in the backfield with Franco.
We're talking with Rocky Blyer about a new expanded and updated edition of his biography, the story of Vietnam and his recovery. It's called Fighting Back, an updated edition. Well, thank goodness the formations in pro football back in those days, back in the 70s, were different, Rocky, because today, you know, most teams just have one featured back. But back in those days, you and Franco played this in the same backfield together.
Well, that's right. And so, you know, they did. They had two backs. They had, quote, the halfback, and then they had the fullback. And within the system in which we ran, and Franco was predominantly running the ball carrier, as we've come to see and know during that period of time. And so I was happy to be able to play whatever role I could play within the success of the team. And so I ended up being the blocking back within the system that we had. But yeah, you're right. You know, rules changed. Things were a little different at the time. Although we were receivers, but not as much as they are today in the open, open offense that they have, and especially with one running back. So Franco and I, and so you think about the success of the team, then you also think about the people that we had, not only offensively, but defensively, but offensively, the offensive line, merged together so that by 1976, Franco and I became the second set of running backs in the history of the NFL, each to gain 1,000 yards rushing in one season, which was really a landmark because it didn't happen that often. So it was a great testimony of not only the defense stopping the opponents, but the offense and line to be able to control open holes. We could run the ball, eat up the clock, and move the ball down the field. And so being a part of that otherwise wouldn't have happened.
I've talked with veterans on this program, Rocky Blyer, World War II veterans. I can remember one gentleman in particular who was World War II guy, so he was well up in years, but his son took him back to Saipan, where he had fought in World War II, and I can remember him sitting here in the studio and telling me about how he scooped up a little tube of sand from Saipan and brought it back with him. I've talked with other veterans. I talked with a guy who fought in the Battle of the Bulge. I said, did you ever get the desire to go back to Bastogne, to Luxembourg? And he said, never in a million years. I don't want to be near that place. So, you know, it varies from guy to guy. You went back to Vietnam, did you not, before you got there?
Yeah, I went back in this year. I went back in August, I should say. And so it was an interesting experience. I didn't know what to expect, only primarily because of the fact that, as we were talking about 1968, we were talking about the Vietnam War. Obviously, it was not a popular war. So those veterans that returned during that period of time were, identified with the conflict, which was, as I said, not popular. They were identified with the conflict, and so they were spat upon. People thought of them as baby killers, et cetera, et cetera. So it was very difficult, and so they repressed their feelings. Coming back, got married, got a job, went back to school, whatever their situation was, but no one really ever talked about Vietnam and or that experience specifically to them. So when I came back, I obviously came back to the Steelers, high profile. It became a story. So I had to come up with answers to questions of, well, what was it like? Well, how did you feel? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I thought I had a pretty good catharsis feeling of not having to repress those feelings like the majority of soldiers had to.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back, and we went back to the exact spot where we had the firefight where I got hit.
Oh, wow.
So I'm sitting in this field, but as we're driving out, all of a sudden, Vietnam 50 years later is much different than 50 years ago. And we worked out of an LZ called LZ West, and we're driving by LZ West, and it's just a hillside. As we're driving, all green, but we're on a roadway, two lanes, there's buildings, there's not hooches out there, there's like little townships and cities, and people are progressing and they're moving, and it's just not the same. And I'm going, man, this whole thing has changed. We used to sweep through this area and come across these little villages of huts and so on, and so that doesn't exist anymore. So it kind of changed, and we got onto that rice paddy. And I guess, you know, the question was asked, well, what do I feel? So all of a sudden there was a sense, an extreme sense of loss of what had taken place. Of 50 years, of 58,000 soldiers died here, you know, for what? Not that the Vietnamese aren't great people. They are, and they love Americans. It's just like, wow, it was a political war that did not take place, and I wasn't really touched with that kind of emotion. Mm-hmm. And I had to... I teared up, and you know, and I had really had this emotional feeling of just of losing so many people, and as I said, kind of for what reason? A political war on decisions that had been made and those who had died, and so there was this great sense of loss. But I'm glad now that I went, you know, and at least to face that feeling. And overcome my reluctance, I suppose. But I do not need to go back. Yeah. I can tell you that.
Yeah. Let me talk a little bit. We're chatting with the Rocky Blyer folks. If you're tuning in a little late here, maybe just got into the car, wondering who's on with Dave today. It's Rocky Blyer, a legendary Steeler running back, badly wounded in Vietnam, came back to play with the Steelers again. Talk a little bit about your relationship with Villanueva, Alejandro, the Pittsburgh Steelers lineman right now, because I understand that you've met with him and talked with him, right?
Oh, yes. You know, so when he came, when he was signed with the Steelers and came in, and so I had reached out to Alejandro just to, you know, introduce myself and say hi, only because of the fact that he had served, you know, went to the academy and then served over in Iraq and came back, and I knew people were going to be pulling on him in all different directions, and I just wanted to make sure that, you know, he felt that, you know, he had a sense of somebody he could talk to if questions arose and so on. So when we decided to come out with this book, I asked Al, if he would write the foreword to the book, and he was so gracious in doing so, and did a wonderful job of being able to capture the essence of the book and in his foreword, and the impact of, you know, of serving the military, and, you know, and what it was like. And so as I said, I was very grateful. So we've been in touch, and, you know, and he's gone through his little trials and tribulations with the team, especially when they went through that process a year ago about taking a knee at the national anthem, and he stood out in front of everybody and through the national anthem and stood in the runway and when it was played, and so everybody, you know, grateful for him for making that stance. But that's the way Al is, and so he's a really a great guy.
Alejandro Villanueva, his three tours of duties, by the way, in the Middle East, Iraq and Afghanistan, right, for Alejandro. And his story with the Steelers, you know, it parallels yours a little bit, because he was not a star. He was not even a starter initially when he came back from the Middle East in those three tours overseas. But ever so gradually, he worked his way in, and now he's a stalwart on the line.
Very much so. You know, I mean, so he'd been away from the game, you know, for those 4 years, which is a lot, you know. I mean, it's a lot of not being able to be there. I don't care what kind of shape you're in. It's a matter of experience and playing shape and, you know, constantly learning and so on, in which he had to do again. And you're right. So, I mean, the nice thing about Alejandro is that he's a great athlete. He's got the size to be able to play offensive tackle. He's got quick feet, you know, and he's a smart guy. And so he's able to pick it up. Obviously, as you said, it doesn't happen overnight. And it would take a year, take another year, take 3 years, and, you know, finally, he's in that role. So, it's a great story, again, about not giving up or wanting to play and working hard to be able to do that. Lessons that he learned while he was at the academy, lessons that he learned while he was serving, but also by playing football and what it's all about, and teamwork, and giving your all for your teammates.
I wanted to mention Gene Collier. He was on our program a couple of years ago. He was doing a speaking engagement or something here in the Butler area, and I asked him if he'd mind coming on with us, and he was very gracious, and we had a wonderful chat. He's a funny man to start with. He's very, very witty, but just a fabulous writer. It was Gene Collier who wrote the play "The Chief," right? About Art Rooney.
He did. He wrote the Chief, and then he wrote my one man play called "The Play."
Mm-hmm.
He did a remarkable job. He's got a great sense of timing and words and being able to capture the feeling or the essence of what took place within minimal words. And it was a very successful performances that we've had.
When he wrote two additional chapters for your book, is that about your life since the first edition of Fighting Back, or what specifically did Gene call you?
We've got an epilogue in it. The first one is the first chapter. It's about my daughters, my two daughters that my wife and I adopted from Russia, or the Ukraine, actually, when they were 2 and 3 years old. So I'm out of an orphanage and went over there. So that whole experience of what they had gone through and then having come back to Pittsburgh. And so captures, tied into what had taken place since the last writing of the book. But anyway, we moved it forward into that. And then the second chapter was about the play and how that came about to be, and the impact of writing that play, but more importantly, the decisions of why and how and what he thought and so on. So those were kind of two chapters in the world with what had taken place, bringing up to date what is happening today within my life. So he did a great job being able to capture that.
Well, our time is fast expiring here. Just a couple of closing notes with Rocky Blyer. I was reading from a story that I think it was on Steeler.com by Teresa Varley, and I just wanted to repeat this quote that you gave to her, Rocky. There was a lot said about Vietnam, and I don't know if it's been told from the point of view of the average soldier of trying to get through, trying to come home, and not die. And that's right. One of the things that Rocky talks about in the newly expanded and updated and revised edition of Fighting Back. Where can people find your book, Rocky Blyer?
Well, they can find it in two places. One, they can go on fightingbackforveterans.com is a website that we have, or they can go to rockyblyer.com. Or more importantly, they can go to Giant Eagle, and we've got a great business relationship with Giant Eagle, and so there are 67 stores that carry the book. If you want to pick it up immediately, you're able to do it that way, or we'll send it out to you to the post if you go on online. So either way. So it's either at fightingbackforveterans.com, rockyblyer.com, and/or at Giant Eagle.
Rocky, what a pleasure to talk with you today and kind of reminisce a little bit about the glory days of the Steelers and about your career and about your life. Really nice to talk with you.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks very much and giving me the opportunity to talk about the book and bring people up to date of what's happening. So I do appreciate it.
Our
so
pleasure.
Thank you.
Our pleasure. Thanks, Rocky.
So long. Bye-bye.
What a great guy, huh? What a humble man. What a story. What a story. Rocky Blyer. Okay. We'll move on to the next segment of the program. We'll take a break here, but we're going to talk about where people are going on vacation this year. Where are they thinking about going? Tracy Ciprian will join us from Butler Motor Tours on the next segment of It's Your Turn. We will be back after these messages.
If you're thinking about buying a car, truck, or SUV, or even if you just bought one, make sure you check out the great rates at Armco Credit Union. Through February 28th, you can get a 60-month loan on new and used vehicles for as low as 2.24 annual percentage rate. We'll even refinance your loan from another financial institution. It's never been easier to join, so call today for other rates and terms or visit us at armcocu.com to become a member. Armco Credit Union is an equal opportunity lender and federally insured by NCUA.
For more than 130 years, the name Concordia has meant quality care. Today, Concordia Visiting Nurses has provided high-quality, skilled nursing and a variety of therapy services to people in and around our community. Concordia Visiting Nurses is here to foster your recovery right in your own home. If you're in need of home health care, choose Concordia Visiting Nurses. Call toll-free at 1-877-352-6200.
Goan Postal in Butler is the area's leader for convenient shipping. You simply give them the item you want to ship, and they handle the rest. How easy is that? And they can help you with your Valentine's Day shopping, too. They've got a selection of Pflüger's chocolates, Valentine's Day cards, and locally produced honey. If you need to ship something for Valentine's Day, your first and only stop is Goan Postal Butler, between Kings and Villa Grande restaurants on Shockey Lane, just off Newcastle Road in Butler. It's the Tuesday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR. We are awaiting the arrival of our next guest, Tracy Ciprian, scheduled to visit with us. She's not here yet, but she will be shortly, we assume. Hey, I want to talk to you a little bit about what's coming up on tomorrow's program. We've got Justin Brackenridge with us tomorrow. We're going to be talking about a Butler County Crops Conference that's being sponsored by Penn State Extension. Sounds pretty interesting. Justin will have the details for us tomorrow. And also tomorrow we'll be chatting with Jim Boltz from the North Pittsburgh Chamber of Commerce. So it'll be first time to meet him. Jim Boltz with us on tomorrow's program. So, that's our lineup of guests for Wednesday. Probably going to be a snowy day tomorrow. This has been crazy weather over the past couple of weeks. It's very cold, and then it's very warm, and then it gets cold again. Now, today we've got rain. It's going to change to snow tonight, and we're looking at some snow showers, at least for the first part of the day tomorrow. They don't seem to be too worried about huge accumulations, but it's going to be colder with the highs only in the 20s tomorrow, and then on Thursday right back up we go into the mid 40s. So yeah, it is crazy weather. How about that chat with Rocky Blyer? Even all these years, decades later, it's inspirational, isn't it, to hear his story? He's a running back after all, and he's wounded twice in the legs. Well, once in the leg and once in the other foot with a hand grenade and an AK-47, and he recovers. Doctors initially told him he might not even walk again, and he recovers to play football, professional football. And how about Art Mooney sending him a postcard when he was in the hospital in Tokyo, sending him a postcard with this message: "The team isn't doing very well. We need you." Signed, Art Mooney, the Chief. Wow, what a great story. Okay. We'll see if our guest is joining us here shortly. We'll be back right after this.
This Valentine's Day, take your sweetheart out for a home-cooked meal at Michael's Restaurant. Dinner specials start at 4, featuring chicken penne alfredo, chicken marcella, or surf and turf. Be sure to save room for a homemade dessert. Celebrate Valentine's Day at Michael's Restaurant on 422.
Rich is just a really, really, really good guy. The term good egg isn't enough to describe him. He's also certified organic and free range. Rich puts the cap back on everything. The toothpaste, the the olive oil, the shampoo, everything. He lets his 10-year-old nephew beat him at virtual tennis, even though he can straight up slay his 10-year-old nephew in virtual tennis. When the toilet paper is running low, Rich replaces the roll on the actual holder, not just on the back of the toilet. Rich is texting and driving. Rich? No. What are you doing, Rich? I was just telling everyone how great you are. Texting and driving makes good people look bad. Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org, a public service announcement brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
In 2019, Tri-River celebrates 25 years as your Butler neighbor, providing exceptional musculoskeletal care in the community.
Hi, I'm Dr. Tom Mazzanegro, known by many as Dr. Muzzy, and I'm an orthopedic hip and knee surgeon. Patients do best when they are engaged with the process, educated, and invested in their own well-being. At Tri-Rivers, the patient is at the center of everything we do.
To learn more or to schedule an appointment, visit TriRiversMSK.com or call 1-866-874-7483.
I love to win, and I'm coming back to defend my title as the winner of the third annual Men Who Cook Golden Fork Award. Hi, this is Jimmy Chipri, and just letting my fellow amateur chefs know, it's game time on Saturday, February 23rd for Men Who Cook, presented by WISR and Armstrong. The cook-off takes place at 6 p.m. at the Vagabond Hall in Lindora. I'm perfecting my entry and just want to alert the other chefs that my entry this year is even better than last year's. So bring your A game. All of you are welcome to come in and try the other great food, but you'll probably still vote for me again. Seriously, it's a great event with over 25 men cooking soups, entrees, desserts, and you get to try them all. Plus, DJ Pat Gallagher will be spinning all your favorite tunes. All fundraising throughout the event benefits the St. Vincent de Paul Bank, and attendees are encouraged to bring a non-perishable item, preferably pasta, for them. Tickets are just $20 pre-sale at the radio station, or you can get the tickets for Men Who Cook online. That's Saturday, February 23rd, 6 p.m. Vagabond Hall. See you there.
Well, we've just been informed that our guest is not going to be able to be with us today because of a family emergency, so we're most sorry about that. We'll be rescheduling our visit with Tracy Ciprian very shortly, as soon as we can. Okay, we are going to, in the meantime, take a second listen to one of our interviews from the past here as we wrap up the It's Your Turn program. So let us take another break here, and we'll get ready to do that for you in just a couple of minutes. We'll be back.
Struggling to find a fitness center that will comfortably meet your needs? Give the fitness center at Applewood Chiropractic a try. Applewood has the only executive-level fitness center in Butler, providing a clean, safe, unintimidating environment with top-of-the-line, user-friendly equipment, fitness classes, and a full-time professional staff to assist you. Don't let fear keep you from being the best you can be. Applewood Chiropractic Health and Fitness Center, Thornapple Drive in Butler. See more at applewoodchiro.com.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to. Nope. I'm sure you've got a perfectly good excuse. Kids, work. I get it. You're busy. So what better time than now? Let's begin. Raise one finger if you're a man. Ladies, none yet. Oh, count in your head if you're driving. Now, three more fingers for everyone over 60, two over 50, one over 40, one more if you're not physically active. Another finger if anyone in your family has type 2 diabetes. Another if you've got high blood pressure. If you're overweight, raise another finger. Two if you're very overweight. And three if you're really overweight. You've just taken the world's first audio prediabetes test. And if you're holding up five or more fingers, visit doihaveprediabetes.org or talk to your doctor. There's no excuse, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Going to be talking about some World War II history that maybe many people might not be aware of here on the It's Your Turn program on WISR next. Listeners, if you're just joining us, I'm Dave Malarkey. Our special guest is Samuel Kleiner, who joins us by telephone. Samuel Kleiner is the author of a book entitled The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of American pilots who waged a secret war against Japan. Sam, nice to meet you. Great to have you with us for a few minutes here on the program today.
Thank you so much for having me. Thrilled to be here with you.
Yes, this was a secret war, a covert operation, and this was before Pearl Harbor, so you know, the whole operation would probably have scandalized an isolationist U.S. population at that time, would you say?
Absolutely. And that's one of the fascinating things about this book, is that we tend to think of World War II as starting on December 7th, 1941, with the attack on Pearl Harbor. But really what this book is about the conflict that precedes that, and that's an area that really interested me. So the story picks up with the story of Claire Chennault, who's an Army stunt pilot, who leaves the U.S. in 1937 and goes to fight with the Chinese Air Force in the war that begins between Japan and China. And so it's just a fascinating story, really, about starting with this group of mercenaries that are fighting against the Japanese 4 years before America gets involved with World War II.
Yes, and once again, unless you're really familiar with World War II history, you might not realize or remember that Japan was at war with China long before Pearl Harbor, so that has been going on for a while. And Claire Chennault, is that how you pronounce his name? Chennault, am I correct?
Yeah, that's how you pronounce his name. And you're absolutely right. And I think when most Americans think of World War II, we think of the D-Day landings in Normandy, or we think of the flag raising in Iwo Jima, but we don't think of China as part of the war. And China's been referred to as the forgotten ally from World War II. And I think it's important that we think about that alliance, particularly in light of everything that's happening today in the news. And this helps to shed some light on the relationship between the U.S. and China. But at its core, this book is really an adventure story. This is about a group of young American men and some women who decide to kind of give up everything they know to take up the chance to go to China and participate in this secret operation. And they go over in 1941 before Pearl Harbor and then launch into battle in December 20th, 1941 is their first battle against the Japanese over the city of Kunming, China, and they shoot down a number of Japanese bombers. And amidst all of the news about the destruction of Pearl Harbor, the series of American losses across the Pacific, and the fear of an invasion of the West Coast, this small group of ragtag pilots quickly become the foremost story about America at war. Hollywood rushes out the John Wayne movie in 1942, The Flying Tigers, and they help boost America's morale and make Americans believe they can win this war. But the story's really been forgotten, and so what I've been doing the past couple of years is uncovering it through finding the families of the Tigers, meeting the last surviving Flying Tiger himself, and going through reams of combat reports, diaries, letters, to tell the story in a way that's authentic, and you can really hear the voices of the participants in it.
Mm-hmm. I can remember when I was a kid, Samuel Kleiner, there were a couple of years there where I was building model airplanes, and there were a couple of companies that put them out. They were plastic, and it was a kit, and, you know, you really didn't need to be all that smart to put them together. But I built one of those planes. Was it a P-40? Is that what it was, a Flying Tiger?
Absolutely. It's a Curtis Wright P-40 built up in Buffalo, New York. It became one of the most iconic images of America at war. It wasn't a fantastic plane, but it was what Chennault had to use, what they were given. And so they had 100 of them. And they would do anything they could to kind of keep those planes flying. And they obviously, you know, had some pretty serious action and would lose planes. And when I talked to the last surviving Flying Tiger, Frank Lazonski, who was a crew chief, he talks about how they had a graveyard, essentially, of downed planes. And when they needed a part, they would go scavenge around to find something. So it was really, this kind of can-do spirit that animated the group and to keep the plane flying.
Even if you're not familiar with the various aircraft of World War II, you've probably seen a picture of this one, folks, because it had a very rather distinctive paint job on the nose. Right, Samuel?
Absolutely, yes. It's this very famous image of the shark-faced plane. It's funny. I feel like I now see that design all over on backpacks and T-shirts. And it's definitely one of the most iconic images of America at war. So this is definitely a unit that I think a lot of listeners will be familiar with. But at its core, the book is about, saying, who are the pilots and the people behind this mission? And I wanted to really discover that. And one of the best parts of writing this book was the fact that I came along at a time when there were only a couple of surviving Tigers left, and they have these annual reunions that I was invited to as a historian, one of the first historians to go to these, and got, just documents of all different kinds about the unit from the family members. And to have a relationship with the last surviving Tiger has meant the world to me, and was able to go down to Columbus, Georgia a couple weeks ago where he lives and give him the final copy of the book and to assure him that this history will live on for future generations. Wow. And with Memorial Day approaching, I think it's an important book as well because so many of these men didn't make it home, and the book honors their legacy. I think of a pilot from Iowa named Bill Reed, who wrote in his diary about how his trip across the Pacific was the first time he'd been on a body of water bigger than a lake back home. And he had an amazing tenure with the unit and then was ultimately killed in 1945. And his memory hasn't really, been honored in the way that I think it should be. So this book is trying to kind of bring their stories to the forefront.
When these approximately 300 young American men and women who were secretly recruited from the armed services to go over there to China, did they travel under their own identities, or was this really a covert operation that they have to go under false names?
It's a great question, and they would travel under passports that were issued under their own names, but listing false professions. So they would oftentimes be going on these ships with passports that listed them as missionaries, and so that led to some funny encounters along the way with other people because they couldn't say, that they're U.S. Army pilots who've left and are now part of a covert mission to go over and fight against the Japanese because America and Japan were still at war. There was a lot of secrecy around the operation, but quickly the word got out, and so this almost threatened to start a war with Japan even before Pearl Harbor. But I think the reader will learn a lot about kind of the history of that period and the various different kinds of international intrigue that were going on. And that's what I think is so compelling about this period of history is, there's kind of the history you learn as a kid in, the classroom from your history teacher. But there's so much more going on behind the scenes that we don't really talk about. And this is what this book is really about. If you're, an avid history buff, you don't need to know a great deal about World War II or World War II planes at all. But this is just one of those fascinating adventure stories.
One of those things that you have to know to really understand this is that prior to Pearl Harbor, the U.S. was maintaining a position of isolation with regard to the World War. It had already started, of course. Japan had invaded China. Hitler had occupied much of Europe. But the United States, there was not a lot of anti-war sentiment in the United States, and we really didn't mobilize either literally or figuratively until after Pearl Harbor, right, Samuel?
Absolutely. We really didn't tackle the issue of getting into these wars, but Roosevelt was trying to secretly or covertly do things to assist the Allies where he could, helping the British, sending over 50 destroyers, helping the Chinese through this secret program. And so Roosevelt, and I think he emerges as one of the most fascinating characters in some way, because he's trying to maintain U.S. official neutrality as a position, but also kind of moving America closer to war as he's aiding the Allies. And obviously this is essentially an act of war, sending over Americans to fight against the Japanese. But it was done in this very clandestine way, using shell companies to move the ship, to move the planes. And there's that kind of covert operation that sets the stage for covert operations that will happen decades later. Mm. And in fact, after the war, Claire Chennault becomes the founder of an airline called CAT that would fly around Southeast Asia, and it was generally seen as a commercial airline, but in fact it was secretly owned by the CIA and was helping them to carry out covert operations around Southeast Asia, including some early missions in Vietnam. So you kind of see how this story takes us through, kind of the founding of the modern era of covert operations.
Wow.
So as we think about U.S. foreign policy today, I think there's a lot we can learn from this.
I didn't know any of that. That's fascinating. A quick break, listeners. Fortunately, we have some more time to chat with Samuel Kleiner, author of The Flying Tigers, the untold story of the American pilots who waged a secret war against Japan. Quick break, and then back with more here on It's Your Turn on WISR.
This year for Valentine's Day, give your sweetheart more than a box of chocolates and a mushy card. How about an evening of dining and dancing at Tanglewood, your hometown center for entertainment, Saturday, February 16th, with the Dorrells, featuring music for baby boomers through the 90s. This five-piece band is one of the area's best for partying and dancing. Doors open at 6. Station buffet dinner by Chef George at 7. Showtime at 8. All this for $25. As always, it's BYOB. Tickets available at 287-0021.
Welcome back. I'm Dave Malarkey. You're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR. Our guest on this segment is historian and author Samuel Kleiner. His latest book is The Flying Tigers, the untold story of the American pilots who waged a secret war against Japan. Where did these, I assume there was a central gathering place, Samuel, for these 300 young American men and women when they secretly went overseas? Were they all generally in the same place in Southeast Asia somewhere? Were they based somewhere?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. So many of these guys meet up in San Francisco, and they go over on different ocean liners, actually very luxurious ocean liners where they're traveling in civilians. And they arrive in Burma, which is at the time a British colony nestled up against China, and they go to a remote base near a town called Tongo. And so it's basically in the middle of the jungle. They have monkeys living with them in the barracks. They go hunting in the jungle. And it's by all accounts kind of, just like it's a pretty raucous time. They're drinking a lot. Chenault is training them on how to use the P-40s, but otherwise doesn't care too much about normal army discipline measures. So they have a pretty wild time up until Pearl Harbor, and then they quickly have to, formulate together as a unit, come together, and take on these missions. So their fighting mostly occurs in Burma, helping to defend the British colony in concert with the Chinese, and so they're down in Rangoon, which is where a lot of the battle happens, and then they're also up in Kunming, China, which is hard to describe how devastated the Chinese felt after 4 years of bombing by the Japanese. And then to have these American planes basically coming out of nowhere and stopping the Japanese bombardment just was an incredible thing for them to be able to do. So a lot of the story is kind of, these action-packed combat scenes in Burma and China. And one thing that I was able to do was to find the original combat reports that the pilots filled out every day after their battles. And those helped to show on a daily basis the incredible fighting they were doing. But those had basically been lost because they didn't end up in the National Archives because this was a covert operation. And instead ended up in a basement in Washington, D.C., basically gathering dust. And through one of the family members was able to track them down and to, for the first time, kind of tell the full story of what the Tigers did.
A little bit about our guest listeners. Sam Kleiner is a historian, obviously. He's a lawyer as well, based in New York. Doctorate in international relations from Oxford over in England. Got his law degree from Yale. And I understand, Samuel, it was while you were studying at Yale that you stumbled across a collection of love letters that relate to this story. Can you expand on that a little bit for us?
Absolutely, and it's one of my favorite finds about this whole book is to really be able to have a female protagonist is so wonderful. When I was at Yale for law school, in a basement archive, stumbled across a collection of love letters between a nurse and a pilot in the unit. And these were old crinkled pages when the handwriting was fading. But they told the story of how this young nurse, who's actually from Pennsylvania, she grew up near the Penn State campus and went to college there, then went and signed up for the Flying Tigers as one of the handful of nurses they had with the unit. And on the way over, she met a pilot, John Petek, who's from New Jersey, and they fell in love. And so it's this ordinary love story in a certain sense, but the setting is incredible. They're in the midst of the opening months of World War II, and they would go on these long bike rides together, and then they were separated during the conflict because they were in different parts of where the Tigers were fighting, and they would write these letters back and forth to each other. And that was one of the things when I found that, I just knew that this story needed to be written because it's just such an incredible human story. And so there's these previously unpublished pictures of them in the book, and it really helps to tell the human side of that story.
I agree. So many times history books, and I'm a history buff, but they're kind of dry sometimes unless you have that human element, and you really have captured
it. Absolutely. And the book was just out a week ago, but the most, and I've gotten a lot of really great, wonderful feedback on it. And the most meaningful to me is when I hear from family members of the Flying Tigers, including some of the Tigers who'd been killed. And so they hadn't gotten to meet much of their family. And just got a note yesterday from a cousin of one of them who said, you know, for the first time, I really can understand what George went through. Talking about her cousin, George McMillan, who was a pilot from Florida who was with the Tigers and was later killed during the war in China. And using his letters, I was able to really tell, you know, the human perspective of what these pilots were going through.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation, Samuel Kleiner, that you were able to deliver a copy of your book to one of the last surviving pilots somewhere down south, did you say?
Yeah, so Frank Lozonski is one of the characters in the book. He was a mechanic originally from Detroit and just an incredible person. So he's 98 years old, and we've become close friends through the process of writing this book and having many conversations about his experience. And was just down with him a couple weeks ago to deliver the book, and it just meant the world for me to be able to assure him that the story was going to be told. And we actually had a crew from CNN with us, and they'll be doing a profile of Frank and of, you know, our relationship and the book that'll be on coming out on Memorial Day on Jake Tapper's show.
I am pretty well read on European theater operations in World War II. It's been a fascinating bit of research for me over the past several years. I know that combat reports were prepared after every operation, sometimes after every battle. Were you able to obtain any of those, or did they write any of those from these covert operations?
Yeah, so that's actually been one of the best finds, and no one's really been able to see these before. But the combat reports were written, but they didn't end up in the National Archives where you would normally find them. Instead, they ended up in this basement in Georgetown in Washington, D.C. Actually, it seems like Claire Chennault took them home after the war. And so they were basically just gathering dust, and I was able to get in and see those. And that uncovered just a huge amount of insight that I'm able to give on what these battles were actually like as the pilots experienced them.
Do you know Claire Chennault was from Louisiana? After World War II, I assume he came back to the States. Do you know if he was involved in anything else prior to his death?
Well, it's a fascinating question. He came back. There's a huge homecoming parade for him that I talk about in the book in Louisiana, and he was bitter at the end of the war because he hadn't been kind of invited to go on the USS Missouri to see the Japanese surrender after he'd been fighting them for 8 years. Mm. And by that time, he'd been gone so long that he felt more at home in China than he did in Louisiana. So he ended up going back and basically spending the rest of his life serving Chiang Kai-shek and Madame Chiang. He remarried a Chinese woman, Anna Chennault, who I was able to interview, and who passed away just a couple months ago, and was involved in these kind of covert operations throughout Southeast Asia. So he was deeply involved in this airline called CAT that was owned by the CIA and was doing missions throughout Southeast Asia. So he had a fascinating life and died in 1958.
I have to hearken back, and I'll mention this to listeners, especially younger ones. because we've been talking a lot about China. It was a different regime in China back then. Samuel Kleiner has mentioned that Chiang Kai-shek several times. When the communists took over, Chiang Kai-shek's government was... they ended up on Formosa. Am I correct on that? I'm trying to remember from,
Your history is absolutely right. So there's an ongoing civil war between the communists and the nationalists, and the Changs lead the nationalists. And the war is kind of quiet during World War II because they're both kind of fighting against the Japanese. And so Chenault actually does have a relationship with the communists. The communists would rescue downed American pilots. There's another communist leader in the area, Ho Chi Minh, who was really kind of a nationalist leader in Vietnam or Indochina, as it was known. And Chenault met with him because he was helping to save downed American pilots and gave him an autographed photograph and some Colt pistols. And Ho Chi Minh was known to show off this picture of Chenault because it showed that he had the backing of the Americans. Of course, America later goes to war with Ho Chi Minh in the Vietnam War. So it's just kind of fascinating to see the various iterations of these different groups. And there's a lot of history that you kind of soak up if you read the book, just because it's, you know, the context in which these men are living their lives.
Yes, and we see how it played out in some cases decades later with Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam. One final question, Sam. Our time runs short here. How did you get interested in World War II history? How did that all come about?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with my grandfather was a navigator on a B-25 on the Pacific, and growing up just hearing his stories and going out to the Pima Air and Space Museum where I grew up in Tucson, Arizona, just always kind of nurtured my interest in this period in history. So it's very personal for me to have this out, and fortunately both my grandfathers are still living, so I can have this book to show to them as well. It just means the world to me to be able to get this story out, and especially around Memorial Day, I think it's an important story for us to delve into.
It's a great book, listeners. The title is The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of the American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan Before